cocaine? The time for the hearing has already passed. We would like to begin as promptly as possible. We have a very long list of individuals who have requested an opportunity to appear at today's hearing. I'd like to begin the hearing with a statement. Today's hearing is designed to elicit from representatives of all areas of the campus community their views and recommendations on the status of women at Michigan State University. The hearing was requested by the women, and the Board of Trustees has agreed to listen to the various presentations. Also present are a number of administrators who have responsibilities in the areas in which the speakers are likely to express concerns. Michigan State University's more sharply defined focus on the status of women on its campus is of fairly recent origin. It began with the adoption just 2 years ago of the anti-discrimination policy and procedures and the requirements by the federal government for affirmative action plans specifically covering women. Certainly, the women's movement locally and nationally has contributed to a greater awareness of the issues. For more than a year, primarily through the Office of Equal Opportunity Programs, the university has devoted a great amount of effort to the collection of necessary data, the preparation of an affirmative action plan, and other measures to correct inequities or to eliminate historic practices which have been detrimental to women. Progress is being made. We recognize that some believe this progress is too slow or is transitory. Some perhaps do not fully understand the administrative processes available or the resources with which we have to work. Others have been willing to join in a fully constructive effort to help the university move forward in this important area. All we can pledge, and I know I speak for the trustees as well as the administration, is our good faith in doing everything we can to ensure full equality of treatment for all on our campus. It is in this spirit that we begin today's hearings. We look forward to a lively discussion, and we sincerely hope productive suggestions and views which will help us toward the goals we mutually seek. The board's open invitation to the campus community to participate in this hearing has not been ignored, as one will note from the very long list of speakers. At last count, there were some 27 speakers presently listed. We ask that speakers limit themselves to no more than 10 minutes to provide time for questions from the trustees and to enable us to conclude the hearing at a reasonable hour. In order that board members and the administration have the opportunity to give closer consideration to the views to be expressed, I strongly urge that those who have prepared statements make them available to us. In addition, anyone who wishes to provide a written statement and not speak may send it to the Vice President, Mr. Perrin, who will see that copies are distributed to the board. To begin, I'd like to call upon Professor Mildred Erickson, the University College, on behalf of the Faculty Women's Association. Dr. Erickson.
President Wharton, members of the board, friends, I sometimes feel at a moment like this that I would like to take a nice trip to China. I was asked by the board to represent, by the board of the Faculty Women's Association, to represent them at today's meeting. The Faculty Women's Association is an organization of professional women who have attained their positions in spite of having been told by society, you can't and you aren't. Many of its members are also heads of households. They have faced the failure of our society to take women in careers seriously. If a picture is indeed, is indeed worth a thousand words, the appended cartoon to this paper on career opportunities for women is eloquent. Professionals have faced the tendency of society to regard women either sublimely or basely or ridiculously. They have faced another attitude best described in the words of a young law student at the University of Michigan. The woman student, she says, and I would add women generally in a wider sense, is caught on the horns of a dilemma. If she is quiet and does not assert herself in class, she is called passive, and this supposedly proves that she will never make a good lawyer. On the other hand, those of us who are more assertive are labeled aggressive, castrating females who will do anything to get ahead. Somewhere in this process, the woman law student begins to question her femininity and to wonder if perhaps there is not indeed something wrong with her. There are other more subtle attitudes which the faculty woman must face. I use only a few examples. On university campuses, women tend to be invisible. Though they perform in a highly professional manner, they are seldom named to positions of leadership, to positions of spokesmanship, or to committee leadership. If a woman is named to a committee chairmanship, she finds that committee members tend almost involuntarily to address themselves to an aggressive male on the committee until by sheer force of performance she gains attention. She must indeed prove herself anew in every situation. Or the invisible woman finds the ideas she has developed credited to someone else. It is his story, in fact history, and not her story. Justice for the professional woman is not a matter of simple justice, as stated in the latest commission report to the President of the United States. Generations of biases cannot be easily changed. Evelyn Soulereau, in the book Women, Society, and Change, traces the history of attitudes and treatment of women in a most complete manner. Other participants here today will speak to this point. To understand better the situation of the professional woman and her requests, could we become personal? A February 7 article in the Wall Street Journal was entitled, "Dear Mr. Success, Consider Your Wife." The point is made that safety and security, which a man may be able to guarantee his wife, do not suffice where matters of personal worthiness and identity are involved. If your wife found it necessary to support herself, should she automatically be a lesser person? Should she earn 40% less salary than males with whom she works? If she were widowed, would she have an identity of her own? She might possibly be well provided for financially, but would this give her personhood? Must she seek her identity through another male? Do you regard your wife as less able than yourself, your mother less able than your father, your daughter less able than your son? Should your bright and able daughter feel forced to apply for admission to this university as a nurse or a medical technologist rather than as a pre-medical student? Will your daughter prepare for a job that she is told she cannot have? This past fall in her own university, a young woman went to a first session of a class in engineering. There were stares and smiles until a young man said, "This is engineering X, you must be in the wrong class." Not intimidated, the young woman stayed. Then the professor came. He too looked in amazement, if not dismay, and suggested she might be in the wrong class. After her assurance it was the class she was enrolled for, his next step was to ask her if she had had mechanical drawing in high school. No, no, she had not. But she had done much soul searching before coming to the university and had decided on the field of engineering. He then advised her that she was out of place, that she was too far behind the other students, and he had no time to work with her on background. She came to our office to drop the course and to seek a new major. At what point are we willing to give women a chance? How indeed can women move into forbidden areas? Packer and Wagner, writing in the Yale Alumni Magazine in 1970, say, "Graduate school has been described as a test of endurance rather than intellect, and it is certainly time that any candidate needs, it is certainly true that any candidate needs large reserves of self-confidence and determination simply to endure. But consider the position of the woman student. A chorus of parents, educators, and psychologists have all of her life suggested the same tedious litany of inevitable defeat. You can't make it, won't make it, or abnormal if you want to make it. If she drops out of school, no one will condemn her. If she perseveres, she will only win the right to another battle, this time a lifelong one against academic discrimination. The same heritage, environment, and opportunity should exist for children in the same family, and we might add for men and women in the same university. This man and that woman did not choose the work or the family roles into which society has pigeonholed him or her. Are females capable of educating young children, but not anyone beyond 18 years of age? The dedicated and professional woman in higher education seeks, one, an unbiased pay policy for work performed. Two, an unbiased promotion policy. Three, adequate representation in faculty positions with good faith efforts in the recruitment of women. Four, adequate representation in administrative positions. Five, adequate representation in decision-making bodies. And six, adequate retirement benefits. I add parenthetically here a figure that I found recently. In 1970, over half of 7.5 million single women and widows over 65 had yearly incomes of $1,888 or less. We are happy to note a new examination is being made of the actuarial tables as they relate to retirement benefits for women. Number seven, benefits for and recognition of the professional woman who is hired on a part-time basis. Eight, for women students, equal educational opportunity in the various colleges and at the various levels. This includes consideration for financial assistance. Nine, opportunities for advisement and counseling for the mature woman and for lifelong education. 10, adequate records on the status of women in the various colleges. And 11, a search for federal grants and outside monies to help in the implementation of actions to increase participation of women in higher education. It is hoped that improvement of the status of women in the university will be viewed not as a defensive action, but with the positive spirit that it is right and desirable to do so. Perhaps everyone here is too young to remember the railroad handcar. I believe the efforts of men and women are needed, one at either end of the lever, to get on with higher education and to work toward an improved society. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do any of the trustees have questions to direct at Mrs. Erickson? No, thank you. The next person, Ms. Josephine Wharton, Administrative Assistant, Office of Equal Opportunity Programs, on behalf of Black Women Employees at Michigan State University.
President Wharton and members of the Board of Trustees, friends, good afternoon. Thank you for this opportunity. At the last Board of Trustees meeting on November 18, 1971, a black woman presented a statement regarding the status of black women employees, which included inequities in employment of faculty, administrative professional, and clerical technical personnel of Michigan State University. You will recall that of the 7 black females who have attained faculty status, the highest ranking female is an associate professor. With regard to the administrative professional employees, which include 10 levels of appointment, all black females are employed in levels 1 to 4. In the clerical technical staff, which includes 12 levels of employment, no black female is employed in any of the 3 highest levels. 85% of these women are at the lower half of the scale. The board was charged to rectify these inequities at all levels of employment by 1, the promotion of black females to positions of authority, that is, administrative, academic, and supervisory. 2, the recruitment of black women in all colleges and units of the university, not limited to the traditional areas of female employment. 3, the advancement of more black women into the tenure system. And 4, the conferring of tenure to black women. Following that meeting, additional research has disclosed a history of inequities involving black women at this university since its foundation. This research has involved careful review, related conferences, and many personal interviews with present and former employees of the university. The Black Women Employees Association of Michigan State University, expanding its base to include all black women employees, submits the following information. Historically, although the Michigan legislature established the State Agricultural School on February 12, 1855, and operations of that school began May 13, 1857, it was not until 1923, 66 years later, that the first black woman was hired at this state-supported institution, and then as a housekeeper. A black woman attained academic status, 91 years later, in 1948, when appointed as a technician. However, it took 110 years for a black woman to attain faculty or academic status as an assistant instructor in 1967. In 1956, this institution's name was changed to Michigan State University of Agriculture and Applied Science. That year, the first clerical woman appeared at Michigan State University. She was hired 99 years after operations of the university began. 2 years later, in 1958, Michigan State University's first black stenographer began her duties. Under the supervision of this employee, 3 black female students were hired on a part-time basis as typists in 1959. The first black woman administrative professional employee at Michigan State University received her appointment in 1968 4 years ago. As a result of the establishment of a program for minorities. Prior to that time, there is no record of a black woman either having been considered or recommended for such employment within the unit of this university. In September of 1969, black women began appearing in higher rank than instructor. Michigan State University appointed a black woman position as its first black female assistant professor that year. An associate professor was hired in August of 1970, and today is yet the only black female associate professor. Also in that year, a black woman was named assistant director in the financial aid's office, but was later declassified to financial aid's counselor. A black woman with a master's degree in counseling was also employed in 1970 as an academic advisor, but on a part-time, temporary basis and without fringe benefits. In 1971, two black librarians were hired by the university, one of whom is classified as a bibliographer. Also that year, Michigan State upgraded one of its black women to the position of food service manager in one of the 22 cafeterias on campus. By August of 1971, there was a total of 4,013 female employees on campus. However, only 279 of that total were black women. Black women represented 13% of the female labor employees, 4.2% of the clerical technical females, 3.8% of the administrative professional women, and only 1.9% of the female faculty and academic staff. It is noted here, the higher the rank of the employees, the lower the percentage of representation by black women at Michigan State University. To date, February 25, 1972, the total number of black women identified as employees of this university is 329. Twenty-one are holding rank above clerical technical level, that is, seven are faculty, seven are academic staff members, and seven are administrative professionals. The clerical technical salary payroll includes 91 black women, the labor payroll 217. In the labor payroll category, which has the largest number of black female employees, only six of these 217 black women are in supervisory positions. Also noted is the fact that out of approximately 220 employment units at the university, only 60 of these units employ black women, or approximately one-fourth of the units. The total number of food and building units on campus is 86, with only 30, or approximately one-third, employing black women. As you can see, mobility of black women in the labor force at Michigan State University, as far as changes in job classifications and salary promotions within the classifications, is at a very low rate, as indicated by the records of black women employees presently employed and those who have already retired. Our research has revealed some very questionable employment and promotional practices at this land-grant, state-supported institution. Why is it that a capable, qualified black woman with a background in business training was hired in 1943 as a housekeeper in one of the dormitories and retired in 1970, 27 years later, still employed at the same level? Why is it that a black woman with a bachelor's of science degree in police administration could only get a part-time position as a clerk in the library? How much education or qualifications must a black woman have? Black women are tired of being overqualified, underemployed, underpaid, and excluded from positions with promotional opportunities. All forms of discrimination at this university against black women must cease. The black women employees of Michigan State University, examples of discrimination, a group oppressed by racial discrimination as well as sex discrimination, hereby present to you the indisputable facts as they pertain to university employment to date. There is absolutely no reason for this university to maintain this status quo. The only alternative is to correct these inequities and effect progressive change for the benefit of the entire university. For when the minority is benefited, the majority also becomes a beneficiary. Now, the creation of a system of inequities involves carefully calculated, deliberate, and contributory efforts on the part of those in positions of decision-making and policy implementation. Therefore, the establishment of an effective and stable system to provide and maintain a climate of equity in employment throughout the university is the responsibility of you, the governing board of Michigan State University. Furthermore, to safeguard the present and future rights of black women employees and to promote equal employment of black women at Michigan State University, we submit the following additional recommendations. One, create within the total personnel unit of the university an administrative position with adequate supportive staff and sufficient budget. This position should be filled by a black woman with responsibility for the establishment and implementation of policies involving recruitment, upgrading, and promotion of black personnel at all levels of employment. Priority and special attention should be given to providing top-level positions, that is, administrative, managerial, and supervisory. Second, provide a staff position to be filled by a black woman equipped to confer with other black women employees and respond to their specific needs and problems. Three, establish key administrative positions for black females in the academic units and central administration of the university. Four, appoint a black woman as an associate or assistant dean in the office of the vice president for student affairs to provide access to the central decision-making process by minority students. Also, employ black females in areas of administration, student governance, judiciaries, residence halls, and graduate programs of that office. 5, provide black women employees representation in residence halls. 6, expand the present format for distribution of information regarding job openings and promotional opportunities at Michigan State University to include all levels of employment. With such information distributed to all departments, units, and organizations within the university. 7, establish in-service training for black women of the university at all levels of employment under the auspices of a black coordinator to capitalize on personal qualifications not being utilized, and to develop skills to enhance the economic lifestyles of these employees and their families. These in-service training programs, which ultimately would be beneficial to the university itself, should be developed and provided for employees by appropriate departments and units of the university. Such in-service training programs we recommend would provide that the employee be promoted first and then be given on-the-job training rather than in-service training for some future job which may never materialize. 2, neither the prospective position nor the on-job training be restricted by age. And 3, employees being trained for new on-the-job positions be paid the regular rate of pay for that position. Our 8th recommendation is that we provide programs for supervisors and managers of the university employment units for the purpose of sensitivity and the creation of better human relations throughout the university as it particularly relates to the employment of black women. At this time, we again charge you, members of the Board of Trustees of the State Institution of Higher Learning, to specifically designate the necessary percentile of new positions to black women to effectively increase the overall percentage of black women to a minimum of 12% at all levels of employment. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Do the trustees have any questions to direct? Just a minute. Trustee Huff.
First of all, let me express my agreement with your statement in general. I'm not quite in the position at the moment to pass on some of the specific recommendations, but your recitation of the problem is certainly very helpful. Now, I just want to philosophize with you a minute here and see if we have some agreement. 2 years ago in this university, 2 years ago next week, we passed the so-called Brookover Report, which established procedures against discrimination. And in that report, the board wrote in, of course, all the language we could think of at the time to eliminate discrimination on the basis of sex or color. 2 years of experience with that document have left us where you so well point out today we are. I agree with you that it is the responsibility of this board, but as you know, and we all know, many of the levers of power in this university are in the hands of administrative people, not in the hands of the board. The board is a policy determining organization. Many of those levers of power are in the hands of black administrators. And there was for a time I thought, and many expressed it to me, a resistance by black administrators in this university to recognize the amount of discrimination that goes on between men and women, both black and white. I'm of the opinion that we're beginning to make believers out of most of those people, and I'm hopeful we're coming to a period when the full intent of this board in the Rookover Commission 2 years ago may now begin to be realized. This hearing here, I think, is the best evidence of that. Now, you just can't change people's lifetime habits of discrimination, whether they be black or white, men or women, overnight. But do you have an organizational program in addition to this that can help those of us on the board who are trying to achieve those goals to monitor what progress we make, and literally to change people's minds and hearts? Because that's what we're up against. We can write these regulations, and we do write them, but they don't go into effect. I just wanted to draw you out to see if you could express some further ways we can bring this university together on some of these problems instead of tearing ourselves apart. I know the people on this board pretty well. I think all these members of this board are genuinely committed to equity of treatment. And I think our administrators are genuinely committed to equity of treatment, except that you get all this foot dragging and the fact that you don't have positions now, and you don't have money, and you don't have this, you don't have that. And in the meantime, time goes by, and there's no redress of grievances. I don't know whether this leads you to say anything further or not, but if you have any comments on this, I'd appreciate some guidance as to how you move people in this university.
How you move them? I would think that you would set the tone by further publicizing what information I have just given you today, that Michigan State University has a sordid record as it pertains to the employment of black women here at the university, and that you're unhappy with it. And you, as august body of Michigan State University, reputable men and women, are concerned as we are, and that you would throw your support behind us in affecting a more representative pattern of employment of black women at the university. Now, we don't intend to do the work. You know, we're pointing these things out to you, but I would be happy to assist in identifying people in all levels of employment, at all types of academic ranks, to fill positions which you would recommend be created in the various departments and units of the university.
Your organization is going to remain in effect, is it?
It's a continuing organization. We are an association of 329 women.
Mm-hmm.
We are concerned about our employees. We're calling our concern to your attention. We want our employees upgraded the same as all other women employees at the university. We want more black women brought on the university. As I pointed out to you, we have 1.9% representation of black women on faculty. Now, that is incredible. And we have some black, beautiful, intelligent women who can fill those vacancies to bring up the percentage to at a minimum of 12%. We will help you identify those black women if you need that assistance. Now, Mrs. Kerrigan was the one who herself sort of goaded us on by saying that women had not set their goals high enough, and to come back here with some higher goals. Now, we are bringing you those higher goals to effect, not to catch up necessarily, but to start from here and create an atmosphere of fairness at this university, which will set the tone for other universities in the nation.
Thank you.
Do any of the other trustees have questions or comments? Not. Thank you very much. Next, we have Gloria Blackman, Academic Advisor, University College. University College Academic Advisors.
President Wharton, members of the Board of Trustees, ladies and gentlemen, I'm speaking today for 26 women staff members who are academic advisors in the Office of Student Affairs of University College. I would like to tell you briefly who we are, what we do, what our needs are, and to offer some concrete proposals for upgrading our status. We hold temporary 10-month appointments. Two women work full-time and the other 24 work half-time. All have bachelor's degrees and eight have master's degrees. In 1964, recognizing the importance of advising for its freshman and sophomore students, University College initiated the concept of an advising center staffed by educated women employed on a half-time basis. At first, the University College Advising Center was only in Bessie Hall, but as the program grew, and in order to accommodate the students living in all parts of the campus and to relate to the living learning philosophy of the residence halls, advising centers were also developed in Brody, Wonders, and Fee Halls. It was not difficult for the assistant dean of University College to find humanistically oriented women in the community willing to do the job of advising students. We believe that this group of women has proven to be stable, competent, completely loyal and devoted to the university and to the concept that the student should be the central concern of the university. All the women have had previous professional experience in a variety of careers: teaching, social work, nursing, retailing, personnel, etc. Most are mothers of college-age children. About half the group are faculty wives. Most combine career with homemaking, significant community involvement, and continuing education. The duties of the University College Advisor are myriad. There is the primary responsibility to the 3,400 no-preference freshmen and sophomores who are undecided about a major and who need a great deal of individual assistance in selecting courses according to their interests and backgrounds. Advisors need to have an abundance of information to help these students. Information about the 130 possible undergraduate majors and programs, about vocational prospects, about all the other resources on campus from which students may get help. But beyond assisting no-preference students, University College advisors provide important services to all of the 14,000 freshmen and sophomores, regardless of their major. I will try to describe very briefly some of these areas. One, working with students in academic difficulty. Students who are below a 2-point average and who may also be below MAPS, minimum academic progress scale, are invited in for individual conference. The record is reviewed. Referrals are made if there seems to be an emotional or health problem. Study habits, choice of courses, credit load are discussed. Tutoring may be arranged. Encouragement and emotional support are offered. Two, offering academic information and assistance to students who do have a declared major. It is a common practice for students to change majors. 60% of the freshmen and sophomores do annually. We help those students who are unsure of their majors and want information on other possibilities. Increasingly, many departments and three colleges have turned over to us the academic advising of many of their underclassmen. On our part, this entails keeping up to date with all the programs in the university through constant contact with the other colleges, keeping an extensive file of vocational and academic information, making referrals to other offices like the Counseling Center and the Placement Bureau. 3, maintaining good liaison relationships with other campus agencies, for example, with the Counseling Center, with supportive services, with the residence hall staffs, admissions office, the registrar, the ombudsman, and the health center. 4, serving as administrative assistants to the Assistant Dean of Student Affairs of University College. In this capacity, we keep academic records, issue drops and ads, correct errors in student records, notify professors in case of student illness, review transfer evaluations, change majors, write letters of recommendations, confer with withdrawing students, act on the readmission of students whose grades are below a 2 point, and perform uncountable tasks which really defy classification. Last term alone, fall of 1971, the University College advisors held 11,000 individual conferences with students. It is really difficult to enumerate every aspect of our job, but more important is the philosophy under which we operate. Each individual student is important and indeed precious as a human being. Whatever his problem or question, we attempt to help him with courtesy, respect, and concern. We recognize that Michigan State University is a vast, complicated maze to many students, to new ones in particular. And we feel that it is our responsibility to try to help them through that maze and to interpret the university's purpose, philosophy, challenges, and opportunities. Students at Michigan State are not at all homogeneous. They're from small towns and large cities, from this state and from others. They are rich and poor, white and non-white, advantaged and disadvantaged, full-time and part-time, radical and complacent, living on campus and off campus. Some are veterans, some are older adults, some are physically handicapped, some are emotionally ill. All are here to get an education, and in our small way, we would like to help each student feel enriched by his contact with Michigan State. We think we're doing an important job for the university. We know that our immediate superiors value our work, as do the students we serve. But we feel that central administration and the Board of Trustees may be unaware of our service. We always knew that we were not being sufficiently compensated materially for our work, but we consoled ourselves with the belief that our real reward was the inner satisfaction that we derived from helping students. But perhaps one does not have to preclude the other. Now that there is an opportunity to express the needs and problems of women at this university, we feel that we should bring to your attention the inadequacies of our situation and to propose some solutions. 1, although we are professionally trained women, all holding bachelor's degrees and 8 holding master's degrees, our salary range for half-time employment is from $2,300 a year to $3,693 a year. That is the most that any of us get. And this is according to the length of service. We propose, therefore, that the level of our salaries be raised to be commensurate with our education, our experience, and our responsibilities. 2, we are on temporary year-to-year appointments, usually not notified until late in the summer, after the budget is set, of our reappointment for the coming academic year. Those of us who started with the program are in our 8th year of service and are still temporary. We feel that there should be some job security even for part-time staff. We propose, therefore, that permanent status be granted after 3 years of full-time employment and 6 years of half-time employment. Credit for past service should be given to persons currently holding the job. 3, we hold the title of assistant instructor, a meaningless title denoting only low status. We are neither teaching faculty nor in the AP classification, nor do we wish to be. We do propose, however, that a meaningful category be established in the university for those who perform academically related professional service. 4, as part-time temporary assistant instructors, we are excluded from staff benefits. We propose, therefore, that we be included in all fringe benefits that are available to faculty and to AP personnel. TIA, CREF, hospitalization and disability insurance, pension, and as is available to AP, tuition reimbursement for 5 credits of coursework a term. There has come to the forefront much national concern over the status of women. And we agree with Dr. Alan Pfeiffer, president of Carnegie Commission, when he says, no university should wait to be forced to adopt a plan of affirmative action. It should take the initiative now. Thank you.
Trustee Carrigan.
I expect before this day and possibly night is over, we are going to hear some incredible stories. We heard one in November when we learned the status of employment for black faculty women and black women generally. But I must say that this is a match for it, in my opinion. With our commitment to serving a broader arena of students with extending educational opportunity to those who are typically underrepresented at universities, the demands of the academic counseling role become increasingly important to our success. I certainly hope the comments that Mrs. Blackman has shared with us will be considered very seriously. I find this an inequity that cannot be called anything but exploitation.
Do any of the other trustees have either questions or comments? Thank you very much. Next, Florence Stevenson, graduate student representing Michigan State University Women's Alliance. Oh, Ms. Nyberg? Vicki Nyberg will go on first.
I will speak, and then Barry Thorne will speak, then Flo Stevenson, then Colette Mosier, then Jacqueline Brophy, and then Elizabeth Santos. Last month, the working paper for the Alliance was distributed to all the trustees. I would assume by now you have read it, know our recommendations. This is to go through some of the points. A common myth is that opportunities for women in American society, though not equal, are opening up and that discrimination is steadily declining. When we see that the share of master's and doctor's degrees earned by women was higher between 1920 to 1940 than it was during the decade of the 1960s, and that women's median salary income as a percent of men's decreased by 5.7% from 1955 to 1968, and that the plight of women in education and the job market has not improved but worsened. Specifically, women students, employees, and future participants of MSU have either been locked out are locked up in traditional women's activities. Let's look at some of the specific areas that are capable of adjusting this system. 1, the affirmative action plan. The number and availability of women as positive role models for the undergraduate and graduate student are a vital part of her educational experience. As Dr. Carrigan has pointed out at the Faculty Women's Association annual banquet on April 27, 1971, the ability to work out a solution depends in part on an access to other women. In this light, let us now examine the Affirmative Action Plan for Women submitted by Equal Opportunity Programs. If you'll turn to chart number one that was in the Alliance proposal. You can see the various colleges. What we did was rework it and not give how many positions there will be available, nor how many will go to women, but how many are there now, how many will be there 3 years from now. Well, we look at agriculture, and they're going to hire 3 more women. Arts and letters, 21. Business, 3. Communication arts, none. Continuing education, 1. Education, 10. Engineering, none. Human ecology is going to lose a woman. Madison, 1. Moral, none. Briggs, none. Natural science, 7. Social science, 12. University College, 4. All 3 colleges of medicine will hire 8 women. The provost office will hire none, and all the other administrative offices will hire none. That's affirmative action. Out of 14 colleges, only 4 can be shown to have a goal of any significance: arts and letters, education, natural science, and social science. The other 10 colleges were either given minimum goals, 3 or 4 women, or asked not to increase the number of women at all. The provost and other administrative offices were not even to increase the number of women by 1. Not 1 new administrative woman will be at this university 3 years from now. A great deal of rhetoric was expounded on behalf of various colleges in relationship to the tight economic conditions. Yet, the 3 medical schools, 2 of which are just starting to expand, were lumped together in 1 category with a total goal of 8 hirees. I wonder how many people will be hired by those 2 medical schools. The use of index goals for administrative positions and the College of Human and Osteopathic Medicine is a dubious practice, since the percentage of doctorates granted women in 1968-69 has nothing to do with the number of women available for administrative jobs, and further, nothing to do with medical colleges, which pride themselves in hiring faculty from all the different disciplinary areas. The goals for hiring women from 1971 through 1974 are based upon, quote, availability as evidenced by the number of women granted PhDs in 68-69 as a percentage of the total number reported by the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. This practice results in regression where applicable at all. Hiring based upon that 1-year figure fails to take into account unemployed and underemployed women from many other years who, in fact, are available. And there have been women since that time who have been granted PhDs, and they're not necessarily employed. It appears that projected hiring plans do not stem from affirmative goals, but rather from the inadequate status quo. Definite numerical objectives are required in the face of continual erosion of numbers and status of women in academic positions. 34% women faculty by 1974 would appear to be a very realistic goal, since that is the percentage of non-foreign women graduate students accepted into the programs during 69-70. By then, they will have all graduated. The second area, counseling facilities. Recently, it has been well advertised that the need for applicants in the, quote, women's areas, such as teaching, has greatly decreased, and that we must stop guiding people into these fields. Yet, advising and counseling facilities have not been updated at the university, as was just spoken to. Even today, as the need for new teachers declines, today we've been recently informed by the MSU faculty bulletin that physical education is only for women who wish to go into teaching and not into professional athletics. This is the article from the bulletin. If it is wrong to use university facilities, as it states in that article, as farm teams for professional athletics for women, then it is equally wrong for men. However, the real question is not really a moral one, it's a legal one. Separate but equal facilities cannot exist at a public institution. Ability is the only criterion. If 3% women wish to become coaches, then training facilities already exist. It will not cost more money. It's about time that the individuals who prepare budgets and those who fund these budgets should stop perpetuating blatant and illegal discriminatory situations. At this point, according to this article, which now says that the women get $3,000 from the men's fund, and they will, in future times, be able to get $15,000 from the men's fund, it looks like that the ability to keep women as second-class citizens costs more, as all inflation does. It used to cost $3,000, and now it'll cost $15,000. What a waste of money. Let's look at the other present structures for handling women's issues. And this is for any discriminatory issue. The present university structure is inadequate to handle discrimination against women on this campus. This is directly in relation to the Brookover report that Mr. Huff was talking about. The committees are set up to respond rather than to initiate action. They handle only individual cases where the burden of proof is on the individual charging discrimination. This fails to take into account the true nature of the problem, which involves subtle discriminatory practices, relationships between men and women, and the strict socialization process most people have experienced. Office of Equal Opportunity. The current structure has proven inadequate in resources, understanding, and implementation of pattern discrimination. The assignment of a woman to handle complaints of discrimination by women was certainly an effort in the desired direction. However, this minimal type of staff cannot possibly deal with all the situations arising from the pervasive inequalities in the treatment of nearly half the total university population. Even though racial minorities constitute a smaller percentage of the total numbers than women, the several men in the office have already more than enough to do without the burden of having to come up with additional programs for women. For these reasons, an office to handle programming for women must be established. Here is an example of how the system works. If there is discrimination, what do you do about it? Well, the Brookover report evidently set up a triumvirate: EOP, Committee Against Discrimination, and the Judicial Board. This is a series of documented discrimination cases that we have filed with EOP. I will read you only the opening paragraph, which is from Mrs. Mary Sharp to Dr. McMillan. On October 20th, I visited with two representatives from the Alliance to End Sex Discrimination. They asked me to assist them to file a list of complaints alleging discrimination on the basis of sex against a number of university units or departments. The following is an attempt to place these complaints in an orderly fashion and to file them with the Committee Against Discrimination, with the request that this be investigated by that committee to determine their validity. I will not go into the cases. However, this letter is dated November 3rd. It is now the end of February, and the only thing that has occurred from the Committee Against Discrimination is a letter to the police department saying, you do now have openings, you should hire a woman. That does not take care of 40 other cases. The Committee Against Discrimination is a body that has no authority to hear cases, except after prior screening by the Equal Opportunity Office. But worse yet, the board has created a situation that is really a straw man because the committee has no enforcing powers. We have presented over and over our cases. I have told you what's happened to them. The worst part is, however, that even if they had said, "You are right, there isn't one thing they can do about it," except to let it go on to the third and last body, which is the Anti-Discrimination Judicial Board. This is theoretically an important vehicle for responding to the problems of women. However, in 15 months of existence, it is hearing its first case concerning women. One of the problems, of course, is that this is strictly a legal interpretation. At the point where you go to the judicial board, you may have a lawyer. However, in order to present your cases, you have to be the average Joe Schmo knowing nothing about legality and hope that it gets to the judicial board. In summary, this triumvirate is unable to deal with the problems except in a legalistic way. However, one must be able to present one's case to EOP